Welcome back, everyone, to Constructive Uncoupling, the podcast devoted to amicable divorces. I'm Judith Weigel, your host and amicable divorce expert. Why? Because that's all I do, amicable divorces. Today's episode, titled, When Compromise is Not a Good Choice. Anybody who's listened to this podcast for the past year or so knows that I always talk about divorce being an issue of compromise. And it is. Normally. Everything in life is a compromise, but especially when it comes to a divorce in a normal situation. In the garden variety divorce, and there are things like that, where people have fallen out of love, or unfortunately, someone has fallen in love with someone else. It's hurtful when this happens, but these are your standard reasons for divorce. Compromise, when you've grown apart, is important in order to move forward. There are situations, though, when compromise is not an option. And this is what I'd like to discuss today. The A number one, when your spouse has a substance abuse and you have minor children, that is the A number one reason or situation in which you cannot compromise. You just can't compromise. And here's where compromise goes. You want to negotiate a co-parenting plan that allows your addicted spouse to be with the children alone, just to be nice and just to get the divorce finished. But if you do, and something happens to the children, they can be taken from both of you. And that's what most people don't realize. That is the worst situation in which you can compromise the health and welfare of your children simply because you need to get the divorce over with, because the pain is so great. You've dealt with this situation for so long, and you just want to get it over with, or you have someone else in your life you want to get together with. And the only way to get this divorce concluded is if you compromise and allow your substance abused spouse to be with the children without someone else being around. You really need to talk to an attorney, first of all. This is such a serious situation that if you allow this to happen, you really, really don't realize that the children can be taken from you. Because what if something happens? The substance abuse spouse is driving or is in the house and not paying attention. Something happens with the kids. You both have to go to counseling. You, the parent who's not addicted, who does not have substance abuse issues, you have to be the clear-headed parent, and you have to really negotiate for that in favor of the health and welfare of your son. So let me tell you two stories. Years ago, when I first started, there was a young mother with an adorable three-year-old child, simply adorable. I never met the husband. He only communicated on text, or not text, email once in a while, or maybe I could get him on the phone. But I could tell there was a problem because he wasn't sounding grounded when I talked to him. I don't believe he had a job. And when you can't get in touch with somebody, when their cell phone isn't working half the time, when they can only be remotely accessed once in a while on email, even I know there's an issue that has to be dealt with. But anyway, so this young mom comes in and wants to do joint custody. Now, I'm not an attorney, so I can't give counsel. All I can do is ask for them to think about why they're making the decisions they're making. And I did ask, why are you filing for joint custody? If everything you've just told me about your husband is true, that he has a lot of substance abuse issues, that you've already been to child support services and you can't force him to pay child support, and now, by the way, he's moved to another state because his mother died, And he's living in her house, but he doesn't have a job. And the only way he's surviving is by bringing in other friends who you have met and you know to also be dealing in drugs. First question is, what is your thought process on asking for joint custody? And she said, well, I want to get the divorce over with quicker. Okay. And so how does this look? He's in another state. He's not paying child support. Well, I would just put my son on a plane. I know you're probably falling off your chair now. I would just put my 3-year-old son on a plane so he could visit his father. And when I heard that, I just said, I can't do this for you. I can't be the one who files for you. I know I'm using my own judgment, but I'm thinking of your child, who I met, by the way, most adorable child. And I said, I can't do it. You can find an attorney or somebody else who will probably do this for you. But if anything happened to your son, I would actually feel in some way responsible. So I'm just going to exercise my options and say, if I have to return any money, whatever you want me to do, but I can't do this for you. She brought her father in, who said thank you to me for not doing this. No, we're not going to be filing for joint custody. And if I have to eventually hire an attorney for her so that my grandchild is protected, I will do that. And so it ended that she got full custody. The divorce was over and she didn't have to jeopardize her son. But if it wasn't for me and her father stepping in and just saying, look, each in our own capacity, no, we're not going to be party to jeopardizing this little child. She would have found somebody who would have done it. And who knows what would have happened to the child. So compromise is not an option. And then I had another client who, and by the way, I like these two people. Generally, when people come to me, I always find good things about them. But good people make bad decisions sometimes. So this young lady, knowing that her husband, when he was her fiancé, did have a substance abuse problem, and because of a very legitimate reason, he had just a horrible situation happen to him when he was younger, and he was still grappling with it even though he was in his 30s. So trauma, he was still suffering from trauma, and my heart went out to him, but he was seriously addicted to drugs. And who knows what kind of drugs. Once in a while, he would agree and admit, but mostly he wouldn't. So in the mediation, we had the therapist who was treating them and me, the mediator. And we both explained that her mom's only recourse in filing for custody was sole custody until, and here's where the compromise could come in, until you're sober for however long she feels you should be sober for, because she's allowed to make those decisions. You cannot be with your children without a supervisor. It's called monitored visitation. So visitation can take place. You can see your children. But if the supervisor feels that you have taken drugs, if in their opinion, they have to be somebody who understands drugs, who can look at the behavior pattern, look at the eyes, look at the physical behavior, if they feel drugs have just been taken, then they can end the visitation schedule or they can end the visitation for that day. So she did file for sole custody, but we put a step-up plan in the settlement agreement. And she got to say how many months she felt would be appropriate in which he's clean and went to drug testing so that she could feel confident letting the children be with him. So she did not want to keep the children from him. Sorry about that. She did not want to keep the children from him. But she did want to keep the children safe. I mean, she was almost ready to compromise and let him have the children unsupervised, but then she finally came to her senses. I think she also went to an attorney who said the same thing. No, you cannot let somebody who has a serious history of drug abuse, and you know, and you can tell right now when he's taking drugs, can't let your children be with him. No, no, no. This can move forward, and the court will hopefully support this. Okay, so that's the biggest. Let's go to the next one. Child support and miscellaneous expenses. So this is a tough one because your spouse can either never pay child support or your spouse has been, let me rephrase that, because your spouse either has not been able to truly support the child because their work is very inconsistent, or you have been financially coddling your spouse throughout the marriage, listen hard on this one, and even though he or she is earning money, you can't stop coddling. We really get into these codependent situations where for one reason or another, we don't require our spouses to step up to the plate and provide. And there's so many different reasons for this. I won't get into that this second. The worst thing you can do, though, is continue coddling when you're in a divorce situation. So in a marriage, it's one thing, but when you're getting divorced, everything changes. And the coddling and codependence that you experience during the marriage is, in certain situations, just may not work in a divorce. May be the absolute worst thing you can do. This would be the time in a divorce where you have legal professionals involved to help you stop coddling and allow the people you've hired to present the process by which child support and the division of miscellaneous expenses is dealt with normally. So you need third people, you need third persons, you need an attorney, you need a mediator, you need a legal document preparation company. You need people to jump in and just, first of all, just explain the basic principles of child support, what it pays for, and then all the miscellaneous expenses, which are far more than what child support pays for, and how they are looked at by the court, and where that starting point is, which is generally 50-50 for the miscellaneous expenses. And then, at least in California, there's a calculator that we use called the Disomaster that will calculate child support. And child support on a monthly basis pays for food, shelter, and clothing. But then there are all the miscellaneous expenses, and those miscellaneous expenses are far more expensive than food, shelter, and clothing. Now, this is interesting. I'm going to tell you a story about a couple that I got divorced. Again, very nice people. They really both, in their own ways, wanted to do the best for their children, for their child. Well, she and he, when they came to me, virtually made the same amount of money. He actually was making a little more than her. She, though, on the other hand, not only had a very consistent work history, he didn't have such a consistent work history, went back to school. And it was actually a good thing that he went back to school because then he was in a situation where he really could earn money. And he was probably very good at what he did. And then he had a second job. But then COVID hit and that second job went away. The first job didn't, but the second job went away. It did change the overall amount of money that he made, and what she made actually went down. So when I ran the calculator, he made more money than she did. Yet there was a guilt. This is my assessment of the situation. There was a guilt on her part that she came with inherited money, that she was good at making money in secondary and tertiary ways. And so there was more of a stability with her. But I think there was this driving guilt throughout the marriage that she came from inheritance, he didn't. And therefore, it was up to her to really oversee, manage the money and give in. I cannot tell you the convoluted formulas that I saw being worked out so that he would not have to pay very much support at all, even though he was actually earning a decent living. And the formula for the miscellaneous expenses just kind of made my head explode. I had no idea. I mean, I was writing it and had no idea what I was even talking about. It worked out in the way that I could. I'm not a lawyer. In the way that I could, I asked questions about what they meant so they could hear themselves talk back where the compromise was, especially her. And they actually ended up with a little bit more of a normal situation where they would be dividing funds or expenses at a certain point, and that there was going to be some level of monthly child support paid. But that was interesting to watch that. And it happens all too often that one person will be codependent with the other person, will coddle the other person, and then just try and devise these formulas that a financial wizard couldn't even unfold if the time came for the settlement agreement to be brought to court and argued. You know, you have to present something fairly understandable in your settlement agreement so that people can help you if they have to argue your case. And that wasn't the case here. So it actually ended up okay, but it really took a while to get there. Number three, child therapy. Oh my gosh, sticking with the children. So child therapy. Very often your child's behavior will have changed to the point that because there's a divorce, you now know professional help is needed and your spouse disagrees. And that really does happen. You can definitely see your child's behavior change and you can't brush it aside. Whoever you are, if you're the parent that doesn't agree with therapy or if you're the parent that does agree with therapy, but you want to wait and see how bad it gets, don't let it get bad. If your child's behavior is changing dramatically, and the divorce is the event that was the game changer, you've got to get your child into therapy. You don't have a choice. You will be literally ruining your child's life. You first of all need to speak to an attorney. So steps to be taken. That's always the first step, is talking to an attorney and looking at your options to get your child therapy without the consent of the other parent. If you are considering joint legal custody in which both parents need to sign off on medical treatment, you definitely need to speak with an attorney. There are little caveats to joint legal custody, at least in California, that you can use if you want to be the good guy parent spouse, but you really need to take control over something so specific and potentially so damaging to your child's life as therapy. Or change your custody to sole custody and you'll have to deal with it on a kind of a higher legal basis. But your children come first. You know, you had the children in good faith. You gave them a life. They expect two parents. Now this is changing. Granted, some children are happy if the dynamic in the household isn't good. They want it to calm down and they want a divorce. Well, they at least want two households so that the arguing stops and the stress in the household stops and the fear stops. But you do have to protect your children. That's the A number one thing. You have to protect your children while you're protecting yourself. I'm not going to say one is more important than the other. I kind of think they're both on equal standing and hugely equally important. Well, or is it because of money that your spouse isn't agreeing? Can your spouse not handle therapy? If that's the case, you can look at, well, first of all, pay for it yourself if you can. And then make a deal on some other asset. Maybe don't divide an asset and use your spouse's money to pay for therapy. I mean, you find little deals to make with yourself. There's your compromise. But so that you don't have to compromise on your child's health make a compromise somewhere else if money is the issue? Or is it because your spouse is afraid that somehow he or she will be exposed as being a bad parent in therapy? That happens. You know, people know when they've been good parents and bad parents. They really do. Even if they've had a messed up upbringing themselves and they're repeating the behavior of their parents, they kind of know deep down inside, I think, whether they're doing the right thing or not. You know, yelling, violence, substance abuse, aberrant behavior, not being at home. I mean, everybody knows that's not exactly right. But if it's the case where your spouse is afraid that he or she may be to blame, you just have to sit them down and say, look, that's not the point of therapy. The point of therapy is to get our child to open up, to talk to somebody that they feel safe with, and somebody who knows how to redirect the behavior of the child, how to talk to a child, how to help that child, meet that child at their own level so that the child can accept the divorce, certainly not think it's their fault, which they always do, and really get your child able to deal with the divorce and going forward, how to love each parent and accept that their life will be different, but that hopefully both their parents will express love to them. But your child needs to go into therapy when your child needs to go into therapy. And that's done, end of story. Number four, spousal support. I love talking about this. Accepting whatever your spouse is offering and not allowing legal professionals to at least let you know what spousal support can be before you accept your spouse's offer, even though you may not have enough money to get by with what you earn and what your spouse is giving you. So, yes, I had a situation like that where I didn't understand what was going on in the marriage. It definitely looked like the husband was in the power position, but who knows what went on leading up. There could be very valid reasons why the husband or one spouse was literally taking control over what he was offering to his wife. And the wife was saying to me, as I asked repeatedly, wouldn't you like me to run the DisoMaster just so you both know what the guideline number is? And they both said no. And that was all I could do. I am not in the position when I work as a mediator or a document preparation company, I am not in the position of reading somebody their legal rights. That is not my job. I can just say, please see an attorney. Have an attorney talk to both of you. He needed to know what the guideline number was too. And then if there was a valid reason for offering less, he could then say it. It could be an open conversation so that the settlement agreement could be written properly. You know, maybe he was contributing in other ways that he didn't have to. And then spousal support just complemented or finished. And maybe it amounted to being overall more than what spousal support calculators would have provided. You never know. Honesty is always the best policy. I've always said this. But yes, I was looking at their financial statements. I knew she was not going to be able to live on what she was able to earn plus spousal support, plus whatever division of any other asset was. I knew she wasn't going to be able to. But there was nothing I could do other than asking several times, can I run the calculator? And then sure enough, I get a call from her. Well, I really can't make ends meet. This is really difficult. Can we raise spousal support? No. Agreement's been written, sent to the court. Done. And that's the way it happens. It's always after the fact, after the divorce is final. Then people are calm and they can reflect back on their decisions and they have decision maker remorse. You cannot let one person control you. You really, in a divorce, have to have an equal voice. You just have to. When you have an equal voice, when topics are discussed that need to be discussed, that influence how much a settlement will be, you'll always regret your decisions once the divorce is final, when you're clear-headed and can think. So if you're not clear-headed when you're making these decisions, if there's fear, if there's guilt, please seek attorney advice. And maybe that way you can at least say, okay, so I know what the law provides. I get it. I know it would be advantageous and helpful to me to have this, but I still think that what he or she is doing and providing to me is the right thing based on other things that happened in the marriage. And then fine, then you don't have decision maker remorse. But it's not going to happen unless you get legal professionals involved and listen to them. Just listen to them. Nobody wants to hurt you. Well, don't go to an attorney that wants to hurt the other spouse. That's uncool. Go to people that really want to help you be even. And individual in how you make your decisions, just so they're smart decisions. Okay, number five. Oh, this is a good one. When disclosure forms or signing the settlement agreement is not happening in a reasonable amount of time. When to exercise your option of hiring an attorney to force your spouse to submit their disclosure forms or push the signing of their agreement forward, it's absolutely necessary to do. Really and truly, it comes down to time. Disclosure forms in any state have a time limit on them, and the court imposes a time limit so that one person can't stall the divorce if the other person wants to move forward. It really is an attempt to make this a balanced process. But how long is long enough? Well, when the court sends you a notice saying that they want you to move forward with the filing, or if you get called into court to explain why the filing isn't moving forward, use this event as an opportunity to insist on your spouse submitting their disclosures or signing the settlement agreement. It happens all too often. There are different reasons why people don't do their disclosures. First of all, it makes you look at your life. It's a hard reality check on your life. Either what you make, what you spend, how you deal with money, or how you've accumulated assets, or how you've accumulated debt. It's really a black and white window on your life. And sometimes it's way too hard to face. And so I really get how one spouse will give the other spouse time. So one spouse gets their disclosures in, or one spouse will address the settlement agreement, and the other spouse is just persona non grata. Can't get in touch with them. They don't return emails, phone calls. Nothing motivates them. Or they start giving excuses about why they can't do it. And now the time is dragging on, dragging on, dragging on. That's not good when the time is dragging on. It really isn't, because it makes people who don't want to drag the time on, who are dealing with the time frame in which the court wants you to address, they're going to pull back generally on their settlement. So if you're the one who's dragging their feet, please don't do it. It's just such a ridiculous game to play. It is. From somebody who sits and watches this process, I'm empathetic to a large degree. I really am. But then there's a point where, come on, you're going to do it anyway. Let's just move this forward. Now, why? Okay, so this is interesting to know what's going on in the background. Let's give one example, because this happens a lot. You're the spouse who's gotten their disclosures in, or you're the spouse who hasn't, but then did once you got a court notice. And you happen to be paying the bills for your other spouse in some kind of deal you made before you even started the divorce process so that you could have a willing spouse moving through the process. You made all kinds of concessions to pay their bills, either to make it a subtraction from what you owe them on a major asset. Like say, for instance, and this has happened so many times in my cases, one spouse wants to keep the house. It is an equity asset. The other spouse will get significant money. And so the spouse who earns more money, better work record, has a ton of assets, they're now paying the bills for the other spouse and deducting it from what the equity interest in the house is. So where's the incentive to move on for the spouse who isn't doing their disclosures? You've just ruined that incentive. What you can do in this case is go to the spouse who's not sending in their disclosures and say, look, I have to stop. It's been 2-3 years, seriously, 2 to 3 years since we filed. I've been paying all of your bills. There's so much equity in the house that you still have a little left, but we're getting close to balancing out here. And I'm no longer going to pay your bills until you send in your disclosures and move forward. And so what you're doing by doing that is you're not shortchanging the other spouse. You're still paying what you're supposed to pay, but you're just not doing it in the way you were doing it because it's not going to change otherwise. You have to change this dynamic somehow, some way. You have to do something. And I guarantee you your spouse will say, okay. I guarantee you. Because if they do their disclosures and you're able to pay off on all the assets and the remainder of the equity in the house, they're going to have a lot more money immediately. And they're not even thinking like that. Again, we don't think rationally when we're in divorce. We really don't. We don't look at what is in our best interest. And we start behaving in a way that's against, adverse to our best interests. Or your spouse has virtually nothing and is embarrassed to submit their forms. And all you have to do is say, look, it doesn't matter. You know, the people helping us with our divorce don't care. They've seen worse. Don't worry about it. Just get this done. Let me give you the money. And then you're going to be happy and on your way. So you kind of have to assuage that. And don't let them be embarrassed. You have to take the upper hand and either explain that you're going to exercise your option to compel the disclosure forms to be submitted. And you can only do that through an attorney. Your attorney can compel that the normal next step must be taken by your spouse or they will suffer financial sanctions. And that is an option you have. Or move forward without them if that's a possibility. So in the state of California, you can actually move forward on your own if certain things don't happen. If certain forms don't get filed, you can move forward on your own. And still divide things equally. I'm not saying take advantage of your spouse. Never, ever, ever. That's not me. Never take advantage of your spouse. Still give everything that you're supposed to give them, community property, whatever you're supposed to give them, give it to them, even though you may be going forward on your own just to get the divorce over. You have tools available to you, but you have to ask. You have to access legal professionals. Or, and this is a good segue point from this example that I just gave you, a spouse who maybe isn't making much money, has a terrible work history, doesn't have a lot of assets, and therefore dragging their feet on exposing themselves through their divorce, their disclosure forms. If you are the spouse that wants to move forward and that has the consistent work history and has all the assets to divide, and again, is no problem doing it, and your fear is that if you push your spouse, they will get lawyers involved. This is the big fear. You have to forget the fear. Knock that one aside. First of all, If you're fearful that if you exercise your voice, an option to move the divorce forward, especially if this is a financial settlement and there's no minor children involved, this is really important. Because there's a lot to deal with when we're dealing with minor children. But if there's no minor children involved, and because your spouse might hire an attorney, means you haven't received legal advice and are fearful unnecessarily. You really are. Divorce is simply a process of filing court forms at specific times and in a specific order and making settlement agreements. That's what it is. Whether you hire an attorney, do it yourself, hire somebody like me. It's all the same process. Court forms, settlement agreement, divorce is over. So this generally happens when one spouse has all the assets and the other doesn't. Okay. The spouse with the assets is giving power, this is important, to the spouse who has virtually nothing out of fear that the spouse will hire an attorney. And do what? That's the big fear. Well, fear is such a motivating factor in a divorce, in general, in life, but used without logic, without understanding how the law works and that it may work in a positive way for you. Instead, people live in fear and the divorce is stalled without end. So here's the deal. Hiring an attorney might be a good thing. That may be your silver lining, is for your spouse who's dragging their feet to go to an attorney to say, no, yeah, you got to move it forward. You have to do your disclosures. If the court has sent you a letter already and the court has asked you to come into court and given you a deadline by virtue of another court date to get everything done, you've got to do it. And then the spouse who doesn't have money, who's going to an attorney, and the attorney is saying, no, you have to do it. Let's just say the spouse with no money goes to an attorney. How are they going to pay for it? How are they going to pay for an attorney if they don't have any money? Okay, so the fear might be, well, they're going to ask you, right, to pay for it. Well, it's not that simple. So this, again, means you haven't gotten legal advice, because you would then know that in order for you to be required to pay attorney's fees for the other spouse, the court has to approve it and the court has to see a reason for it. And I'm thinking that if you get a reasonable judge who says, what's the problem here? You haven't done your disclosure forms. Just do your disclosure forms. I mean, what's an attorney going to file for? An extension to do disclosure forms and it's 3 years later? I mean, there is a point where the legal system just says enough is enough. Come on. You either use it or lose it. Either jump into the process or you're out. I'm going to make some decisions and they may not be in your favor. I mean, there are a range of decisions judges can make, by the way. So I'm laughing, but it is true. It is true. Don't fear. Don't fear. Don't lay down and play dead because you fear your spouse is going to hire an attorney. For the two reasons I said, with what money are they going to hire an attorney, even for a legal consult? And do you really think a spouse with no money is going to hire an attorney? Don't you think they have as much fear as you do? Don't you think that they fear they could be possibly cut off somewhere, some way, if an argument was made? I think so. But, you know, even people that are not in an advantageous position, if they can see that you have fear, they'll get over on you. They'll use that fear to their advantage just to toy with you, just to extend the time as much as they can before they have to move forward. I mean, people do these things to one another, right? So, okay, compromise to a certain extent, maybe a year, but if there are no children and all this is a financial decision, you do have to take the upper hand. You really do. If you're the one that wants to move forward and finish, and get all your ducks lined up. And if you're tired of, you know, you may want to hold on to your assets too, as long as possible. But if the court gets in the middle and wants you to move it forward, just do it, get it over with, and then everything is great. So those are the six issues in terms of not doing a compromise. And the six issues, just to recap, are when your spouse has substance abuse, when you're coddling and compromising for your spouse with child support and miscellaneous expenses, when your child needs therapy, when you're not allowing legal professionals to inform you about spousal support and it's adverse to your own health and welfare, when one spouse is stalling and not doing their part in the process of divorce with forms they have to submit. And lastly, number six, out of fear of attorneys getting involved. These are definitely reasons not to compromise and to take a stand, move it forward, just so you can conclude the divorce, and then everybody's fine. Nobody dies from divorce. I mean, in general, nobody dies from divorce. All right, that's it. You've been listening to Constructive Uncoupling, the podcast devoted to amicable divorces. I'm Judith Weigel, your host and amicable divorce expert. You can reach me by emailing me at either Judy@constructiveuncoupling.com, or Judith, my new email address, @amicabledivorceexpert.com. Judith@amicabledivorceexpert.com. Please give me your feedback, give me some show topics, subscribe to this podcast, and share this with your friends. The information we give is beneficial to all. Talk to you next week. Thank you so much for your time.